Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hi, my name is Michael Weiss. I am the co-founder, president, and CIO at Yield Street.
Michael, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. Before we talk about Yield Street and where you guys are currently building, give us a thumbnail version of your career to date.
Well, sure. Thanks for having me. So my career to date, I started out really trying to hustle in the mortgage brokerage industry. Really looking to identify real estate finance opportunities. And when the Great Recession came, that wasn't the best place to be. And so I found myself really trying to find a solution to having at least one side of the equation solved, right? So as a mortgage broker, you're trying to find the clients and then you're trying to place their loan with a bank or a lender. And so I ended up being able to get into the alternative investment space and the hedge fund space, where there was at least a defined bucket of capital and I had to find the right opportunities. And so I really found myself, you know, excited about specialty finance, about identifying areas to invest where there was inefficiency of capital. And long story short, where I realized relatively early on that in order to really drive success in the industry, you had to find a particular niche. And the notion of perceived risk versus actual risk really excited me. And so I tripped on litigation finance in 2009, ultimately became one of the largest legal finance lenders in the world. I also got a chance to do some interesting things like provide loans to the NBA players during the last lockout, and really just found myself delving into specialty finance more broadly. About 2013, I launched a fund with two partners. And as I became to really be more successful independently, I started to recognize how access to and distribution of alternative investments was fundamentally broken. People like me were spending too much time raising capital, and investors out there really had a difficult time finding the right investments and the right places to put their capital. And I got really, really passionate about this idea, and that's really what led me to Yield Street.
Wow, that's super exciting. And there's just, you know, so many questions that are running through my head right now, because as an angel investor into, you know, primarily technology startups, that's been, you know, my passion for the past couple of years when transitioning from founder operator to now to the other side and utilizing the experience when I was raising funding for my startups. It's a full-time job, and there's, you know, it's a part art and a science at the end of the day. So utilizing that experience to teach further kind of the younger entrepreneurs and founders, I think that for me that I find a lot of passion in that. So
when you were an operator, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, completely different world. And, you know, to your point in terms of kind of identifying these unique opportunities for investments, because as an LP in other funds that invest into technology startups, it was an interesting journey to really find and identify the funds that really fit kind of my thesis and identify those opportunities. And it seems like what you guys are building with Yield Street is somewhat of a unique value proposition there. So talk to us a little bit more about Yield Street. What type of a niche that you guys are serving? I love the, you know, the framework that, you know, the riches are in the niches. It used to be the more global, more scalable you grow, that, and, you know, these days it's completely opposite. Tell us a little bit more about that. What's the value proposition and where do you see this going?
Yeah, for sure. So, listen, I think I want every single person to ask themselves the following question like 10 times a day. Does my money work as hard for me as I do for it? Like, that's the most important thing, right? We're here, we're doing our podcast, our money should be working for us. We're sleeping at night, our money should be working for us. We're on vacation, our money should be working for us. That's how billionaires make it, right? And so why don't we have the same experience? And so, like, that's really fundamentally what I'm after. It's how do I create equality in the experience in financial services, right? So what's our mission at Yield Street? It's to help millions of people get on a road to financial independence. Period, end of story. Why are we so passionate about it? The income and the opportunity gap keeps getting wider and wider, and we all see it, and we're not doing enough about it. And so we believe at Yield Street that the primary reason that the income and opportunity gap is getting wider is because people don't have a chance to build financial independence, to build a stronger financial future. And I think what people are really after is a chance to invest alongside some of these great managers, some of these great investors. They're not looking for handouts, they're looking for opportunity. And so when you take a step back, you got to ask yourself, like, if the system as it exists today weren't in place and I didn't have the limitations of that system, what would be the perfect experience that I would be able to enjoy with my money? Like, so just really deconstruct how we think about our relationship with our money and how we invest and rebuild that. And that's what Yield Street's after. What we believe that looks like is a digital private bank experience. So if you think about the wealthiest folks in the world, they're getting curated investment opportunities. They're getting the best lending solutions. They're getting great advice on tax, on planning, et cetera. And they're getting great spending together. And so when you think about Yield Street, it's about creating that value proposition for the customer that we are on the journey. Now that takes a long time to create. And so we're still on the investment part of that journey, which is how do we identify differentiated alternative investments with leading managers that deliver real value, real returns, real results, and fractionalize and bring them down to a much wider audience. That's what we're focused on.
Right. No, that's very interesting. Talk to us a little bit about the process of, you know, the fundraising for, you know, for your own fund. I talked to a lot of, you know, GPs and, you know, different types of funds, whether, you know, private market or public market and asset allocators. Was that somewhat of a similar, you know, sales cycle as a traditional, I guess, company or startup would go about fundraising? How did you go about, you know, building those relationships with the potential investors and LPs? What are some of the challenges that you encountered along the way?
At the Yield Street equity level or at the investment opportunities that we bring to our wider community?
Yeah, at the Yield Street. I think that's kind of from an overall fund perspective, that's that would be interesting to hear.
Sure. So I think in many ways, our journey is very similar to others. You're going to have some people that totally get it, believe in what you're building, want to be a part of it, want to jump in. You're going to have some people that think you're absolutely crazy and don't want to be a part of it. So for example, I remember when Melinda and I were raising the seed and we went to a pretty famous investor, like one of like the coveted investors. And he looks at us and he's like, hey, building a business with one strategy is hard enough. You guys have this whole idea of diversification. Like, that's crazy. I don't think it's a good idea. You know, I'm not doing this. And we tried to explain that the entire experience that we're creating requires diversification. Otherwise, what's the point of having one investment strategy? Then I need to have 20 different platforms that I go to. And he didn't get it, but look at where we are today. And so I think we've dealt with the same level of rejection that, you know, traditionally all founders are going to deal with. I think the key is to have sort of a strong foundation, a tremendous amount of resilience, have clarity in your story, be passionate about what you're building, and then just keep hustling through. And, you know, my first job, I used to make 100 calls a day, sometimes even 125. And so my mentor at that time said to me, every no is one closer to a yes. And I think in many ways, I carry that through my life in everything we do. And I think that, you know, raising capital for a startup is the same.
Right. No, that's very interesting. And seems, you know, that's kind of the trend from the overall approach perspective. I love, you know, the framework you just mentioned, you know, the every no is one step closer to a yes. I love that. I might have to steal that from you, but it definitely resonates because at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's a full-time job to go through the fundraising route. And majority of time is just hearing some of the feedback that you can utilize to make things better. So that's very interesting. What are some of the trends and ideas that really excite you these days that you're very passionate about, that you are researching, you know, on nights and weekends? That's kind of in your book would be the next big thing.
So they fall into a couple of different areas. I think the biggest one that I'm passionate about is really understanding like how we as people have changed and how that's impacting how we think about investing, right? And so I'll give you a couple of examples. 10 years ago, we would go to the local butcher, baker, you know, fisherman, flower store, and the list goes on, variety store, hardware store. Today, we go to Whole Foods. We used to shop at, you know, 10 different stores. We go to Amazon. We used to have an Android, BlackBerry and a Nokia or a V phone. One was a phone, one was an email device. Now we use an iPhone or an Android. And so there's a theme, right? There's a common denominator there, which is that we've gone from task-based efficiency. Like I want each store to have the best fish or the best cheese or like the best texting device to saying, I want utility in my life. I want to do more with less. It may not everything is going to be as good, but the totality of the experience is much better. And that's how I want to act. Now look at how you manage your finances. That's not the case. You still have more than one bank account and you still have your IRA, your 401k, you know, you're highly fragmented. And so I think we have to force ourselves to ask, like, in the next 5 years or 10 years, like, are we really going to keep behaving this way and having 20 different platforms or 20 different sites that we go to? And so I think that overall consumer behavior has changed so much that there's got to be a tremendous amount of innovation in finance. I think like that's thinking about what that user journey becomes and how I want to be totally connected is really interesting. So like a realistic example is how do I connect spending and earning together? So if you want to, you know, lease a BMW and it's going to cost you $500 a month, my ask to you would be give me X dollars, invest it, and let that car be paid for by your interest. And so really starting to think about how earning money can solve for what I want in my life and not deplete over time, I think is a really powerful thought that hasn't been really tapped enough yet. So some of these components are really interesting to me. On a very tangible level, you're going through the largest wealth transfer in the history of mankind, from the baby boomers to millennials and Gen Z. And so what does that mean for us? Where is all that money? Like, are you going out to some BS golf event with your financial advisor? Like, is that how you want to spend your time? I don't think my friends want to go golfing with financial advisors, right? I think we want to have a digitally native solution that's at our fingertips, that leverages AI, that knows what I like, that knows what I'm passionate about, that's going to show me an ESG investment, that's going to show me investment in minority-owned businesses, that's going to show me a recovery plan based on COVID and how I could be part of, you know, growing small business. Like, I need someone to do that work for me and say, hey, Michael, here's a silver platter of 5 investments that fit your criteria that you should pick. And so that experience doesn't exist today. And so I like to really challenge myself to think about what is it that Yale Street should really be building, taking into consideration all these changes that we're going through.
Right. No, very interesting observations. And, you know, in terms of the trends, it's as an asset allocator and investor, I would imagine that identifying opportunities in untapped market or untapped industries is, you know, is at the forefront of, you know, one of your strategies. Talk to us a little bit about that process of, you know, the research that you conduct, you know, to identify those really unique opportunities. Just curious about what goes into that type of process. What's the system in place and kind of the overall research methodology?
At an investment level or my own sort of personal journey?
Yeah, the investment level.
So the investment level is amazing, right? There's a team of like 35 professionals that span sort of a level of experience from incredibly, you know, 20-year industry veterans. There's an origination team that brings in opportunities. It flows through an initial screening. If the investment asset class heads feel that it's the right risk reward and it's right for our client base, it goes to something called a green light committee. The green light committee is like an initial committee where we take a look at a given opportunity and we decide if it merits to go further or what kind of questions and what kind of risk the team should look out for during the due diligence period. Once it gets through the green light committee, it goes through a formal due diligence period, ultimately to a credit committee. If it gets voted affirmatively on the credit committee, it then gets funded. I would say we're probably at about an 8-9% approval rate across the platform. So it's a pretty tight screening process. And we've done over 230 investments for $2 billion to date. We have about 300,000 users. In the last 5 years, we've paid back more than $950 million across about 150 individual investments. So team's growing. Team always remains interested and excited and launches new opportunities. Like in the last, you know, since the beginning of the year, we've launched third-party funds. So an opportunity to invest alongside some of the biggest managers like Avenue Capital, Mark Lasry, remember, owner of the Bucks and, you know, big investment platform, Aviator, Harbor Group, as well as launch structured notes, which is a $3 trillion asset class. So we're constantly hungry. We're constantly thinking about like, hey, how do we add more solutions to continue to give our customers more diversification in portfolio?
Right. No, that's very interesting. What type of innovations have you seen, you know, lately in the overall investment space? It's, you know, it's not something that we typically hear in the news in terms of the disruptive technologies or any type of innovations that are really happening in that. What are your thoughts on that? What are you observing? What do you think is what is happening?
So unpopular answer, but I think true. I don't think we've seen enough innovation in fintech. So I think if you think back at 2010 to 2020, it was called like sort of the golden age of tech. You double click on that, there wasn't a ton of fintech in there. So it was like two or three major unicorns that went public from 2010 to 2020. We really think that 2020 to 2030 is the golden age of fintech. So if you look at the adoption curve and you think about names like Acorns, Stash, Plaid, Dave, like all these big brands, Public, Robinhood, are starting to really hit sort of that tipping point where they're bringing products out. The innovation largely has been around payments and around trading. But I think we need more innovation in the wealth tech space. I think we need more innovation in sort of how consumers behave. Some innovation that I think is really cool is the fractionalization of some of these really complex investments or investments that are coveted and hard to access. So fractionalization is one. Regulation has helped really broaden the audience that could invest. So going down to accredited and now expanding the accreditation qualifications is another one. Secondary markets, so creating liquidity in an illiquid alternatives world, like that is amazing to me, right? So people, so 60% of endowments and pension capital, up to 60% is invested in alts, 6% for retail, which is like insane. Why am I not emulating what the smartest people are doing with the most money? And the reason was two things, I think. One is like structural limitations, like practically how do I invest $5,000 into a $100 million deal? Like it didn't exist until, you know, companies like Yield Street. And two is like, it's a 10-year private equity deal. I'm a retail investor. Like, I don't know that I could lock up my cash for 10 years. So creating liquidity in alts by allowing us as people to trade, sort of like, if you think about it, tokenizing assets and then allowing those assets to be traded over time, like that's pretty innovative. That's pretty amazing. There's been some innovation in really the IRA rollover experience. So if you've ever had to do it, it used to take like 50, 60 days. It could take now less than 1 week and just 3-4 clicks. So you're definitely seeing some innovation, but there's a lot of room for growth.
Right. No, absolutely. It's, you know, interesting to observe certain industries that, you know, are not so, I guess, well known in terms of disruptive innovations and things like that, but there's so many opportunities to do things different, to do things, you know, from a creative standpoint. So, you know, thanks for that insight. What are your thoughts on, you know, choosing the career path, you know, in investing, in asset allocation, whatever, in, you know, public or private markets? What advice would you give yourself, you know, the 21-year-old Michael coming out of college? What are the type of skills would you invest in? What would be some of your recommendations there?
That's a great question.
Aside from specific domain expertise, obviously, from, you know, the financial kind of expertise, anything that's maybe on a softer skill or anything from that standpoint.
Yeah. So the one thing, regret's a heavy word, so I'm not going to use that. I'm going to try to find a better word. I guess the one thing I kick myself in the ass about, sorry about that, but it's true, is I didn't think big fast enough. So when I was in school, all I thought about was how do I get that job? How do I make some money? How do I create a living? What's my future career path? And I was so focused on like living within the confines of the system that the average person does, that I really didn't allow myself to believe that I could do something so special, that I can do something that can change the world, that I can do something that can add value to millions of people. And I didn't allow myself to entertain the question of like, if I didn't have these limitations, what could I do differently? And so I think that, you know, kids coming out of school today are hopefully taught more of that, right? Like for us, it was like, you know, being an accountant, a doctor, a lawyer, you know, some trade was really the direction that I got. And so I think that allowing yourself to think big is really, really important. Now, how do you action that more practically? If it was me at 21, I would be looking more at companies like Yield Street or fintech companies or exciting founders that are doing interesting things that are going to challenge you, as opposed to looking at, you know, things that are really more task oriented, going through a particular rotation, getting trained on a particular thing. And so I think that the rate of evolution, the rate of change as a result of technology is so quick, most people really don't understand or pay attention to it. So if you look at even like the last 20 years, the rate of change for these kids as they're growing up, from, you know, cable TV to streaming, from, you know, no iPhones to iPhones, et cetera, is amazing. And getting stuck in an old large institution, I think is in many ways very dangerous. The next component of that is the way to make real money is to own something, period. And so if you go work at JP Morgan or at Goldman, you'll have a great career, you'll have great earning power. But if you go work at an exciting startup and you get interesting option package as part of your compensation, and you keep growing and you keep refreshing and you keep going with them or others, you will most likely have a much better financial outcome if you pick the right companies. And so the summary there is like, you really need to own something. You really need to think big. You really need to be passionate and excited about who you work with and what you're doing. Don't take the easy way out, in no less words.
Right. No, I love those recommendations. It seems so simple and cliche, but oftentimes overlooked, where we reflect back on the time, you know, we're just starting out, especially during the college days. It's always interesting to think about the different priorities, and it's, you know, it's
scary.
It's a unique space. Yeah.
You know, it's absolutely scary too. I bumped into like a professor in my old school a little while ago, and she was like, hey, you know, would you come in, maybe, you know, be part of like our alumni support. And, you know, I said, I was thinking about my past a lot, and here are some of the feelings. And I shared, you know, these ideas, especially the one about thinking big and thinking different. And I said, like, I really wish that that was in the class. And the second thing I really wish we were taught was how to budget. I feel like we get thrown from like high school to college to our own individual life, and like no one actually taught us how to budget.
Right.
It's like, teach us the value of money by doing chores, but like how to live on my own and create a budget. Like, it seems so basic. I talk to most of my friends now, they still don't know how to budget. They either make enough money or they don't, and they have a problem.
Yeah.
And so I was like, if you guys could figure out how to create some curriculum around that, then, you know, I'd be happy to. But I think it's incredibly important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Couldn't agree more with you on that. The last portion of each episode, I talk about, you know, I guess kind of your content diet. What are the different sources you utilize on a daily basis? Self-education for, you know, just keeping yourself informed of what's going on in the markets or whatever the case may be. Share with us those.
Sure. So I would say I consume information primarily in three ways. I have a roster of books that I like to read. I am addicted to surrounding myself with smart people. And so I try to talk to as many people as are willing to talk to me that I respect and that are smart. So industry leaders across the board. And I have a roster of relevant news that I feel is important and interesting to me to stay on top of. If you're doing it yourself, you got to sort of pick your lane. If you have a team, find someone on your team or more than one person who's taking in a lot of content that can filter that for you. And the reason is, if you don't stick to what you think is important for you to learn, then you're just going to end up reading tons and tons and tons of content, and you won't really get a tremendous amount out of it. You might be like the walking encyclopedia, but how to action it is critical. And there's a lot of white noise out there that we just like don't really need to know right now. So that's how I consume content.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And you know, with so much information being available out there thrown at us on, you know, by minute basis, I'm fascinated by the different techniques and strategies on how to be very selective with what you let your mind be exposed to. It's, you know, very, you know, interesting space. You've mentioned books. Talk to us. What are you currently reading? And what is one book that you always recommend to others? And why is that?
So I generally read more than one book at a time. So I split my reading by, maybe I call it personal growth, introspection. I like to be really self-aware. So maybe a book like The Road to Character by David Brooks to me is like incredible, right? It's amazing. It helps you understand that being a person of exemplary character doesn't come easy. And anyone who you would look up to goes through a level of challenges, and sort of makes you really test who you are and understand the different parts of your brain. Then I firmly believe that everybody is going to make real mistakes in life. So you should do the best you can to find others' mistakes and learn from them, right? If we know what's going to happen, I may as well figure out how you dealt with it so I could avoid it. So for those types of books, I like to read about different leaders that I find interesting, right? So it could be someone like, you know, recently I was reading Bob Iger's book from Disney, or Schwartzman's book from Blackstone, Ray Dalio's book on principles, right? And I think the thing you got to take away when you read those books is, I don't have to take everything as gospel. You don't need to agree with every single thing in the book. Some of them have like a tremendous amount of ego infused in them. Like, find the nuggets that are super powerful in each of those leaders and try to at least build on one, two, or three of them. Like, I'm not trying to be Bob Iger. I'm trying to be Michael Weiss. And so I don't need to do everything he did. I just need to figure out some of the things he did that were amazing that I can emulate. And then the third is, I like to get my creative juices flowing. And so that could be mostly nonfiction. So whether it's like The Billion Dollar Whale, The Story of Joe Lowe, or Red Notice. So those are sort of real life examples of sort of crazy things that have happened in business, good or bad, where it gets my creative juices flowing. And I would say once in a blue moon, I'll find myself reading a nonfiction book. And that's kind of my roster. That's how I sort of always focus on growth, always learn from others' experience, whether it's a leadership book or a biography, and keep my creative juices and my excitement flowing.
Right. No, and I agree, especially with books. You know, you mentioned you read more than one at the same time, same here. And it's, you know, it's hard to go through the entire book these days, because I find the majority of them could be condensed into maybe a couple of articles or blog posts versus kind of the overall book. But it's, you know, there's a lot of different unique opportunities. One latest recommendation to me was, I forgot the name of the author, but it's called The Upside of Stress. It's Keith Raboy recommended that. And it's basically kind of looking at the other side of stress and how that actually contributes to our performance, our motivation. You normally being treated as, you know, a negative, but how a lot of very successful people actually view that from a different perspective. So that's kind of one quick recommendation from my side.
I'm in.
Michael, for anyone looking to connect with you, find you, what's the best way to do that? What are the kind of the easiest way for them to reach out and connect?
Email me, michael@yieldstreet. That would be the easiest one. Or I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram. And so come find me on social or LinkedIn. And love to connect with people, love to learn from people. So
awesome. I love that. I appreciate your time today. It was a very short, insightful conversation. What I love doing with a lot of guests is do a follow-up episode in about a year, see how much of change transpired. Revisit the conversation from a year ago and see that everything we've discussed still applies and still makes sense. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
I'd love that. I wish we did it last year, because pre-COVID and post-COVID, I think most of us are new people. So that would have been fun, but I'm sure we will continue to evolve, both of us, and would love to do that, see how things evolved in your world and share with you mine as well.
Awesome, man. Much appreciated.
Take care. Have a great day. And thanks for Upside of Stress recommendation. I'm on it.
For sure.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.